This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Why do people vote against their own economic interests? In the 2016 presidential election, white working-class voters supported Donald Trump, but his tax cuts benefit the rich. Ian Haney-Lopez says it's the result of dog-whistle politics. And politicians use racial fear-mongering to win votes. Been going on for over 50 years. And to fight this divide-and-conquer strategy, Ian says we need to unite and build by creating a multiracial coalition. And to do that, he argues, we have to reframe the way we think and talk about racism. He lays out these ideas in his new book, Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. It's the result of 2 years of collaboration with union activists, racial justice leaders, communication specialists, and pollsters working to build a new political strategy. Ian Haney-Lopez is a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and he joins me now. Welcome back, Ian.
Thanks very much.
Let's talk about dog whistle politics. You've talked about this before, and I think we have an understanding, but this is the exploitation of white anxiety over a perceived loss of privilege, right? And coded language used by, although less and less so these days, by politicians. Just briefly describe how that works.
Well, if you think about a term like illegal aliens or terrorists or welfare queens, or in contrast, silent majority, American heartland, true patriots. These are all terms that on their surface do not directly mention race, but that just underneath are designed to trigger thinking in terms of racist stereotypes. So these are metaphor. I mean, these are dog whistles. And a dog whistle, a literal dog whistle, blows at such a high frequency human ears can't hear it. So it's a political metaphor that talks about, that gestures toward political speech that's occurring on two levels, silent on one, triggering strong reactions on the other. Now, it's important to note, and this was a surprise to me when we started really looking into how this worked. These stories, it's true, are fundamentally about people of color as dangerous or undeserving, as criminals or welfare queens. But once they're translated into these dog whistle coded terms that do not directly mention race, many people of color, indeed majorities of African Americans and Latinos, also found these messages convincing.
Well, that's interesting. What do you think is going? Let's talk about, first of all, the white voters who find this appealing. This obviously speaks to some deep anxiety, and it is powerful. What's at work here? What's the fear, and why is that such a powerful trigger?
We live in a society that for 400 years has been organized around the idea that whites are superior, that whites should be dominant in society, that people of color are inferior, should occupy the lower classes, are subject to exploitation, are dangerous if uncontrolled, are undeserving in their demands on the rest of society. Those sorts of ideas are deeply ingrained in our society, but, and this is a really crucial point, we're not seeing the prevalence of those ideas, the persistence of those ideas, simply as a vestige of old ideas, long learned and slow to be unlearned. Instead, what happened after the civil rights movement is that the Republican Party in particular learned that they could pull the white working class away from a coalition with African Americans and liberal elites by appealing to these sorts of racist ideas. And so the Republican Party developed as a strategy an effort to increase racial resentment and racial anxiety in the American public. That is, we're living in a society now in which rather than allowing racial anxiety to slowly fade over time as we all work together and live together, we actually have some of the most powerful elements of our society investing heavily in promoting racial division because they see that as a route to win power for themselves.
And it's been extremely successful. And I think on the other side of that, it would be fair to say that the Democrats, having seen this strategy right out of the Goldwater campaign, when one political analyst wrote in his column, the Republican Party has decided to become, in fact, if not in name, the white man's party. This is 1964, and nobody protested. But the Democrats then said, okay, then we're the default party. Minority candidates will never be elected, so leave it to us and we'll take care. We'll carry the water for you, which effectively shut out minority candidates from running, essentially, in the Democratic Party. So, I mean, in some ways, would you say that is almost equally insidious as a response to the Republican Party's deliberate attempt to use race as a dividing point?
So what happens with the Democrats is the Democrats understand that racial division is going to be used as a weapon against them. But they very quickly appreciate that dog whistling is occurring in code, and that many people think it's simply common sense to worry about criminals or welfare cheats, and that attacking that sort of rhetoric as racist tends to backfire. It actually strengthens the Republican narrative that we're fundamentally locked in a racial conflict. So the Democrats, as early as 1970, make the fateful decision that they're going to distance themselves from civil rights and from African Americans. They're confident that African Americans and other communities of color have nowhere else to go. So they say to themselves, we'll put their issues on the back burner while we focus on maintaining as many of these white swing voters as we can, these white voters who are defecting to the Republican Party. And what's sad is that this strategy that is adopted in 1970 still has tremendous resonance in 2019. There are still significant elements of the Democratic establishment who are saying today, in order for Democrats to contest Donald Trump and his politics of racial division, we need to focus on winning back swing voters. And to the extent that this has us messaging in a way that alienates people of color or doesn't invest in mobilizing communities of color, that's okay. We can depend on their vote. Let's go get those swing white voters.
All right. I want to get into some of your what to do now as a result of all of this that you write about in your book, Merge Left. But I do want to get back to a point you made earlier about the fact is that with dog whistle politics and this coded language, once the translation has been made and the code has been issued, even minority voters and citizens tend to adopt it or embrace it. Tell me more about that.
What's happening here is these stereotypes are deeply internalized, and you can hardly grow up in the United States without absorbing to some extent this sense that whites are hardworking, minorities are lazy, whites are innocent, people of color are criminal. We have to spend, all of us have to spend an inordinate amount of energy trying to uproot and tear out these sort of stereotypes that we've tended to internalize. That's true among communities of color as well. This does not mean that large swaths of African Americans or Latinos, Asian Americans are suddenly going to start voting Republican. But it does mean that when large segments of communities of color find these messages to be persuasive or common sense, that makes them less likely to go out and vote, less likely to understand why an argument that simply condemns Donald Trump and the Republican Party as racist provides a compelling reason to vote Democrat if that's not how they interpret these messages. We need a different approach, a better approach that not only speaks to whites, but that also speaks to communities of color.
And this is what you address in Merge Left. So tell us about that. You say that we have to shift the way we talk about race and racism in this country. What do you mean? What would that sound like?
The core insight here is that dog whistling has always been about more than simply mobilizing voters in terms of race. Yes, it was about pulling away the white working class, but it was also always about shattering the public's confidence in collective action and government for the common good. So the idea behind dog whistling is to convince working families that they are under threat from other working families and that they're really on their own, and that collective action through unions or through government simply provides no route forward. And instead, They ought to view government as the enemy because government keeps taking the side of undeserving or lazy people or refusing to control dangerous or violent people. And rather than have place confidence in government, they should place their confidence in the marketplace. This sort of politics, in turn, provides a route forward. If we talk about racism as fundamentally a conflict between whites and people of color, we deepen the sense of division. Notice what happens when we reframe racism as instead a purposeful tactic to divide us so that the rich can rig the rules for themselves. Now, this is we are the 99% message that creates space for whites to see themselves not as the enemy beset by people of color, but as valuable allies in a multiracial coalition.
Yeah, but Ian, let me stop you right there, and I do want you to continue. But honestly, that has been the argument. That argument has been abroad for more than a century. The idea, if you remember, when communism and socialism were indeed viable political options around the turn of the 20th century and up to the 1930s, a viable option made that very argument that there is an international class of people who are being hurt by international and global capitalism. We need to unite across international borders as a class and overthrow the tyranny of capitalism. It failed, I might say, because this intellectual argument was weaker than nationalism, which is a national identity, which has always been stronger. No French worker was going to find anything in common with an Italian worker. Well, what about
I'm so glad you mentioned that. You're absolutely right that there is a version of this argument that has circulated widely on what we might call the class left for many decades. And it's a version of this argument that says racism is being used to divide us. It's a tool of the economic titans against all of us. Therefore, we should come together. But be very clear, the basis for coming together purportedly is the fundamental interest in fighting class warfare. And so this is a story that says racism divides working folks. Working folks ought to come together by ignoring race, by focusing on shared common economic interests, and by ignoring race because race divides us. That's precisely the move that one hears sometimes among supporters of Bernie Sanders, for example. They say, listen, race is divisive. We all could use economic populism. Let's unite around economic populism. That's precisely what I'm not recommending. What I'm saying is there's a message that's powerful that says, we know we're being racially divided. We know that racial division is the primary weapon against all of us. Let's come together expressly by fighting racial division. This is a supremely race-conscious approach to working-class solidarity. This is not working-class solidarity that buries attention to racism. Mm. It's working-class solidarity that lifts up the need for all of us to join together to fight racial division and to create genuine multiracial alliances.
I'm talking with Ian Haney-Lopez about his new book, Merge Left, today on The State of Things. It does sound like a slightly different version of the same problem, though, in that you have to use an intellectual and ideological argument to somehow get over this deeply emotional and more deep-rooted sense of political and racial identity. How do you do that? What does the language look like? And how do you do that without, if you're going to allow race to be the centerpiece of this, we are being manipulated by race, we're being divided by race, let's not do it anymore. Doesn't that have the same effect as sort of using race as this kind of wedge?
So I think we can understand what's happening here partly through an intellectual lens. That is, this is an analysis that says, hey, what has happened over the last 50 years and what's the relationship between class dynamics and racial division? Absolutely. But the story itself does not require that intellectual gloss. In fact, the story itself is pretty easy to understand. This is divide and conquer politics. some people are purposefully exploiting division for their own greedy aims. And the reason I'm confident this is pretty easy to understand is we ran a two-year project examining how to talk to people about race and class in the United States. And what we found is when we tried to use different vocabularies, especially vocabularies that talked in terms of structures, either economic structures, the rules are rigged by corporate America, or racist structures, this is institutional racism, people really struggled to understand the abstractions of these structural dynamics. But when we said, hey, this is divide and conquer, people grasped immediately those dynamics because people have experience with divide and conquer in their personal relationships. Now, that's one. Here's the other important point, and it connects to what you were saying. It is not enough to tell people we're being divided. You're right. That sounds itself like just another version of finger pointing. It's absolutely essential that progressives say, we're being divided and we want to come together. We stand for unity. We stand for reaching out across racial lines and for helping people of different classes, of different neighborhoods, of building genuine community, of building genuine neighborhoods. And this works. In fact, our research showed that this message of fighting division by coming together to make sure government works for all of us, whatever our racial group, was the most powerful message among whites, the most powerful message among African Americans, the most powerful message among Latinos, the most powerful among persuadable voters. This is a message of unity that people are really hungry for. People recognize that we're deeply divided by race. They recognize that economic inequality is a growing threat to all of us. And they're hungry for a message that says, we want to come together. We want to recognize each other in the smiles of other folks in our communities, in our state. And when we come together, that's how we're going to make sure that government works for working families and not for corporations.
Ian Haney-Lopez is the author of Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. He's a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley. Ian, thanks so much. Great to talk with you.
Thank you.
You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org, and sign up for a newsletter as well to get the daily lineup. Our show is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hullab-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Tarras, our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.